CliffCentral.com.
It is a Thursday morning on CliffCentral.com. That is our opportunity to catch up on all the things that are going on in the news. And this morning is no exception to that. We're going to do so with Nando's, who bring you the burning platform every single Thursday at 7 o'clock. We get to talk for between half an hour and an hour about all the most important things that are happening not only in South Africa but in the world that have to do with society, with the economy, with politics, and so on. And this morning, as always, I'm joined by Pumi Mashiho. Hey, Pums, who is ready to go with the burning platform this morning. She's always got lots to say and lots to think about and lots to give us to think about. And we're also joined this morning, by Ibrahim Harvey, who is the author of a book. He, first of all, has an interesting history. He's a former Kasatu trade unionist, a political writer, an analyst and commentator over two decades. He's a former columnist for the Mail and Guardian, and his biography of former President and Deputy President Ganema Motlanthe was published in 2012. His new book is called The Great Pretenders, Race and Class Under the ANC's Rule. That's Ibrahim's new book, and you can get it at good bookstores now. Ibrahim, nice to see you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's nice to see you. So, first of all, how's the book doing? And tell us what the book's about so we can all get excited about that, and hopefully some people will go out and buy it and take a look. I think there's so much fascination with the ANC at the moment. What made you write this book, and tell us what the thrust of it is?
Yeah, I think for about two decades, late 1990s, actually, as I said at the launch, when the effects of the macroeconomic neoliberal policy of Gear of 1996, June, took effect, and, there were a lot of retrenchments, and the public sector provision of basic services was seriously affected. You see, this country's demographics, with the overwhelming black majority and more specifically so-called African majority, given the historical links between race and class, the effects of GEAR and all the neoliberal policies the ANC had since 1994 was bound to affect the majority black working class, which is ironically the very historical support base of the ANC. Since the 1950s in particular, the support base of the ANC has been rooted in the black townships. Those were the people who stood loyally behind the ANC during all the tough years, exile, and everything that happened to the ANC. So after 1994, legitimately and naturally, that constituency expected, after over three centuries of oppression, exploitation in one form or another, white supremacy, that at least their basic needs would be attended to. And as I've demonstrated in this book, and in both my master's and PhD, people forget I've studied this area, well, particularly Johannesburg, dealing with water, sanitation, and basic services. It's ironical, deeply so, that you go and walk in the townships today and see what has happened under ANC rule. Well, no doubt COVID has exacerbated the existing, historically rooted divisions of race, class, and gender. But it's a shocking shame. I mean, sewage running down the roads. I mean, local government, particularly now after COVID, has collapsed, man. Mm-hmm. It's a mess. The SOEs, everything, Cliff, is no exaggeration, and I would debate this with anybody, that certainly in post-apartheid South Africa, if not historically, even during the apartheid era, never have you had a crisis as multifaceted and deep and negatively affecting especially the black working class as is currently the case. So this book has been long in the making. But I, in fact, wanted to do it before the Ganema Motlanthe biography. But when that opportunity arose, I took it. But while doing his biography, I became interested in this kind of book, which explored historically. I must emphasize the importance. And historians told me that, continuously when I interviewed them, they said, and I cite them, that the problem with South Africa partly is the lack of knowledge of our history.
Yeah.
And so that is why, I mean, you go onto social media, it's abysmal. Let me be very frank with you, the lack of knowledge and understanding of race and racism. I've penned pieces where I've talked about the emergence of a new black racism column in the Mail and Guardian. I've dealt with this for two decades. There is racialism and racism by black people on social media every day. Because you know why? They don't understand the theory and that what we're, how race is defined and racialism and racism. They don't understand. So there's a lot of emotional venting of spleen or social media.
I mean, you know,
and,
Ibrahim,
it's partly why I felt I needed to sketch this thing historically, Cliff, to go back to the origins of race and to deal with it as thoroughly as possible. I mean, Jesse Duarte has said that she wants to promote this book, that she's going to, that educational institutions, including the Oliver Tambo School, should use it as a research source, you know.
You know,
and I was happy to hear that. You know,
that's good news. Listen, I think the ANC could do with any help it can get from pretty much anywhere at the moment. She was actually abused racially and in terms of her gender this week when supporters of Ace Magashule's said that you know, that they weren't going to follow through with the ANC's decision to essentially suspend him.
So
it's no surprise that she's also dealing with a lot of this herself. But I want to give Pumi a chance quickly. It's been a hell of a week. This is probably one of the worst weeks in ANC history for a long, long time. And there are so many horrible weeks to choose from. So we've finally seen the argument between the two factions come to a head, Pums. And, you know, you've been predicting this for a long time. Ace's people are now definitely the ones who are looking the worst for wear. But it's by no means over, right?
Not by a long shot. But more importantly, will there be an apology coming from Ace? And will the apology remind us of Baba's famous apology, the quote that I should apologize?
Mm.
It's gonna be a bloodbath for a while. But I've been thinking a lot about our conversation even last week about what this is doing for the electoral prospects of the ANC. Like, all we see on the news is ANC left, right, and center. We don't hear anything about any of the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I think top of mind is going to be the ANC. They're going to come out winners on this, hey?
You think they'll come out well? Just because they're getting attention. You don't think it matters whether it's negative or positive?
They've got share of voice. They've got share of voice. And what it looks like is it looks like Cyril is doing something. It looks like Cyril is fighting the good fight. That's all you hear. Cyril's fighting the good fight. Winning the fight.
Just to be clear, because I don't know whether Ibrahim's heard your thoughts on this before, but Pumi is by no means a fan of Cyril's. But what you're saying, Pums, is the perception is that he's doing something finally, and that this will end up making it look like they're moving in the right direction. Ibrahim, you were nodding your head vigorously in the opposite direction. You're saying no.
No, I think there's a... it's a fundamentally mistaken analysis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you're confusing things here. Cyril's dealing with, we should salute his efforts in regard to the, because corruption has become such a huge problem, and he's certainly and sincerely making efforts in that regard and trying to bring along other players. So it's a concerted, genuine attempt. But the crisis is multifaceted. That's perhaps even relatively the easier thing to do, as deep as corruption is. The socioeconomic crisis, believe me, is ultimately far bigger in magnitude than is the political crisis engulfing the ANC at this moment. Now, the one mistake that is made is to say that all this is going to help the ANC the upcoming elections. To the contrary, never before, whether you're talking of local government elections or national elections, has an election been preceded by such overwhelming anti-ANC publicity. Go into the townships, go onto social media. People who are fervent supporters of the ANC. I mean, people have become so, I mean, disenchanted with ANC rule, and they're expressing it on every conceivable platform. So where you get the understanding from that what the ANC is going through now is going to help it at the polls? No. I foresee worst local government election results. Let me make it clear now in this year. You will see it for yourself. It will be the worst results that ANC ever happened.
That is without a doubt that it will be the worst results that the ANC has seen. However, the DA is not going to win. The no, DSF is not going to win from this. Is not going to win from this. I agree with you that the socioeconomic situation of the people on the ground is very bad, and they see it and attribute it to the ANC. So, however, when it comes to the poll, when people walk into that voting booth, they only have so many options. They only have options. And of the options that they have, the top of mind option is the ANC is trying to change. Look, the ANC is cleaning itself from the inside.
I think there's this ground that we've covered here before. I mean, maybe people aren't even going to go to the polls. We may see the lowest turnout ever at this election. And that's not going to do anybody any good.
Mm-hmm. But I think I'm going to just make a quick comment to what you said now, response to it. You see, you're right. It's this question of what alternative is there, you know. But remember, the hegemony of the ANC has seriously declined. And at the polls in particular, you look at 2016 and the 2019, very noticeable declines at the polls. So what is it telling you? These ordinary people that you think is just going to continue with this loyalty to the ANC despite the results. No, I think now really, and you have to capture this moment very clearly. It's not just this very deep socioeconomic crisis. It is that the corruption in the ANC is worse than ever before. It's so deep and so extensive that it's gone down to the ordinary people. Ordinary people in the ANC now, in the townships, they're aware. They've become aware of this, the depth of the corruption. So you have a combination of sources of crises, the socioeconomic and the political. Now, you're right that, you know, the ANC is still dominant, but I'll tell you what is going to happen at this polls. The proportion of people who are disenchanted with the ANC and feel there's no alternative, but then they continue to vote for the ANC is going to decline. Mm-hmm. It's going to decline, maybe not very significantly, but it's going to drop. I think people are awakening, and indeed, it would have been better for this country's political future and his if there were, you know, a significant other opposition. There's the EFF. I think really, if there's one party that you need to watch very carefully, despite the racialism and sometimes racism coming from Malema and those people, you know, is the EFF. I think the DA is going to experience a bit of a decline because of what's happened, Maimani and so on. There's one party, watch it, let me tell you, EFF and Malema.
So you think the EFF will pick up those votes? I mean, Pums, you've said before.
No, not necessarily take up those votes. It's too fluid and complex, the political situation, to deduce that. But their share of the vote will increase from 2016.
All right.
I think the EFF is going to do relatively better than other parties, proportionately speaking.
Okay, but where there are losers, there have to be winners. So then proportionally, they'll pick up just because their voters are much more motivated than perhaps ANC voters are. And there may be a similar argument made for, you know, for smaller parties. I mean, there might be some others that pick up some votes. I want to quickly turn before we always bring it down to electoral politics and party politics, and I think that's really interesting. But I do want to just turn our attention for a moment to the party finances. So this is interesting. Jesse Duarte said in a comment this week that the ANC are experiencing cash flow problems. They've run out of money, basically. They're not paying their own people on time. As a former trade unionist, this must really piss you off, Ibrahim, because you know what it's like as a worker to not be paid on time by your employer, even if they are political. And the ANC is blaming the fact that we now have an ability to look into party donations and party funding, which is something which they supported in Parliament when it went through, I think it was a couple of years ago. Now, how sympathetic must we be to the ANC that suddenly their donors are not as keen to be associated with them publicly as they were 5, 10, 15 years ago? This is obviously their just desserts. So maybe they should cut back on staff. Maybe they have to take seriously the fact that they cannot generate any income other than donations. And maybe the ANC can start to manage its finances a bit better. It's a wake-up call, don't you think?
Cliff, it's a shocking shame. And just remember, this is not the first time. It's happened several times. That Febi Potgieter, the general manager, had to intervene to calm things, even in Luthuli House. I mean, it's a shocking shame. There are several former leading trade unionists, Ramaphosa, Bantash, Mokgalema Motlanthe, etc., who come from NUM into the ANC. One would have expected, especially if they lack sympathy, you know, and sentiment for the broader black working class regarding basic services, my God, at least they would attend to the salary and pay the employees of the ANC. But it's a reflection of the magnitude of this multifaceted crisis. There is no excuse. I won't be surprised. Remember the ANC had this Black Business Council, a forum that they formed. They raised a lot of funding there. I will not be surprised, I'm saying this now in public, that some of the monies that the ANC derived from these sources were also siphoned off into some form or other corruption that might have been happening in the ANC itself. It's inevitable, perhaps, even to argue that that might have happened.
Sure.
Because, I mean, how can you explain, I mean, the ruling party in the most developed, advanced industrial economic in the continent not having money to pay its own staff? Man, you know, I mean, it's just an unspeakable shame as far as I'm concerned. This, and it's a reflection right from Ramaphosa, right down the entire NEC, and certainly the top six. It's an indictment of the leadership of the ANC that they cannot pay their own staff.
I'm not surprised. Politicians never know how to make money. They only know how to spend money, and they only know how to spend money that they've taken from taxpayers. That's how it works in politics. So I'm not surprised at all.
But it's not just that, Cliff. It's not just that. Do you ever see them missing their salaries?
Hell no. Even during COVID, during COVID, Ibrahim, when most people were taking salary cuts, even in the private sector, especially in the private sector, perhaps, where people said, listen, in order to survive, we're all going to have to take a cut. Not so for the politicians. Not a chance. They all carried on being paid.
But that's the thing.
Yeah.
You'd expect them to spread the dealing with this adverse situation and share it, you know, and have cuts, not with the ANC, not cabinet ministers. They made sure that they took care of themselves. This has been the defining feature of ANC rule from 9. You're going to look at, that's why I argued in the book, in inverse proportion, Cliff, to the greater impoverishment of the black and African masses, the ANC's elite grew. I mean, multimillionaires, people who went from rags to riches, either to political office or when they left political office into business. This is the most stark contradiction of the ANC is to look at its own members.
Of course.
Look how they live and look at the ANC's elite in the former white suburbia. It tells you so much of what's happened.
Pumi?
Yeah.
I have a question, you know, as a trade minister yourself. And you've just mentioned all the people that are in the ANC leadership that are also trade unionists, and the relationship that the unions have with the ANC. We know this. It's tripartite alliance and all. How is it not then that the trade unions are just as complicit in the socioeconomic mess we find ourselves in now?
These were their bedfellows.
You're putting it rather mildly. I've written at great length about this. Let me tell you, the ANC is in power partly because of the complicity, wittingly or unwittingly, of the alliance partners, the SACP and COSATU. Without particularly COSATU, what is SACP? Please, man. You know, the SACP is hardly, the SACP doesn't feature in any working class struggles. I couldn't even get them to deal with prepaid water meters to take a stance. Okay. Even the Women's League of the ANC neglected those issues. But, you know, a very big question has to be posed about not just COSATU, the trade unions generally in South Africa. I was in the ANC, COSATU, Witzerl, Noem Well since the 1980s. Look at what has happened to the trade unions with the growth of their investment wings. It has become the source of massive corruption over the years in organized labor, in COSATU, in all the other trade union federations. Nobody wants to talk about this. Now, how can you talk about working class support coming from COSATU and they've not even had serious research into what has happened? to the investment wings. Nobody wants to talk about it.
And Ibrahim, let's also be fair. The unions no longer represent the masses in this country anyway. They represent employed people, mostly in state employment, who are just looking for increases every year. The vast majority of the people who we should be concerned about are people who are completely unemployed and are not represented by trade unions or by political parties at this point. All those young people out on the streets, all those young people in the townships with nothing to do, with no work, with no opportunities, with all this potential and nobody to care for their interests. It's the trade unions who are looking after a tiny percentage of employed people. It's the political parties who will do anything for a vote and then forget about the people who voted for them. And as you say, these elites who are operating at a level where they're just in it for themselves.
No, but Chris, be careful about the how you analyze the membership of COSATU. No, there's a hierarchical thing there. You'll have the more skilled workers, the NUMSA, metal workers. You'll have textile. You have other workers at different scales of earnings, income. And so this notion of a labor aristocracy in the trade union movement, I've had dealt with it for over two decades. It's very careful. And I agree with you to a large extent. Mm. I'm saying don't think it's generally the case like that. And don't also forget that organized labor consists of what percentage? 10, 20%. The bulk of the workers are still not organized into trade unions. This is one of them. But you are right.
But that's my whole point. That
the trade unions are caring more for the more skilled, upper echelon workers.
So is there time up in South Africa then, the trade unions? There's no more space for their role.
And Pumi, just I want to add to this. I would Ava that SADTU, the South African Democratic Teachers Union, is responsible for the non-skilled generation that we are dealing with at the moment because they've been in dereliction of duty from the very beginning, protecting bad teachers, making sure that they get paid no matter what. We know how awful the situation is in many township schools, and this is directly in the hands of SADTU. They have marshaled their resources and their forces and their votes in order to force this government to be soft on bad teaching. We've allowed education standards to slip, and all of this is directly attributable to SADTU. So the unions have not helped in that situation. They've made it much, much worse.
No, but be careful. I mean, I think you're right insofar as I'll tell you, I deal with SADTU in the book. I mean, really, it has to be said, if it still needs to be said, if the public, just the print media alone hasn't reflected this fact. I mean, I think of all the COSATU affiliates, SADTU has just been a huge, huge problem, in so many respects. I think it's one of the worst performing unions in this country. I could talk in various ways about this thing. But again, I think what we do, Cliff, is to approach workers or unions too homogeneously. Mm. There are a lot of members of SADTU who are themselves critical of the leadership and what has happened. We mustn't lump members and their yearnings and wishes with what leadership is doing. It's very important that you draw a distinction between leadership and the ordinary members of the unions.
But then if we're not supposed to lump them together, why do they insist on being lumped into a union? Maybe there's no more space for that.
Maybe unions have outlived their usefulness, and perhaps these unions, having not covered themselves in glory, and in SADTU's case, having actually allowed members to be sleeping with students and other outrageous things, which they've covered up and protected and defended.
Gareth, I think you need to be careful with what you're saying
I'm not going to tiptoe around unions.
Don't use this opportunity. To lash out with seemingly a bit of right-wing rhetoric here, honestly. When you start to question the existence of trade unions in the first place, then I think you're getting going too far. Unions will always be necessary. Why is the employers having the right to have their organizations that represent them and workers can't? They're confronted with serious problems, can't say that this time has come for we
please,
don't need unions anymore.
One of the things that we don't do on the show is say, be careful and watch what you say and don't say this. You could say whatever you like on the show, and I'm happy for you to defend the unions as much as you like. Their contribution has been politically significant, but economically has been devastating for this country. There is not a single thing that the unions have done that has helped people to find employment outside of already having been part of unions. We know that it's a minority of people who belong to unions in South Africa by population. We also know that the unions have been in cahoots with big business and government from the get-go. The only people who've suffered here are ordinary people, ordinary workers, and people who are not unionized. And the ANC's...
Not from the get-go.
The ANC's... The
not
ANC's,
from the get-go, Cliff.
The ANC's...
Yes, later on, but not from the get-go. That's when they departed from their original mandate, even in COSATU.
Well,
yes, that's how they started.
And who is...
Really, it's after 1994 that you see the most serious decline of the trade unions, primarily COSATU, because of its alliance with the ruling...
And who's to blame for that?
That's what happened.
It's nobody except the unions themselves that are to blame for that. Their own weakness, as you say, the leadership...
Well, ultimately, yes. But so the pressure from the ANC to turn the line is huge.
Let me tell you,
I can take you through the affiliates.
I'm not going to feel sorry for them.
But I think, Ibrahim, I'm bringing this back to you.
Yes.
Have the unions in South Africa then outlived their usefulness? So if you say they have departed from their mandate, if you say that they are complicit with government in getting us to the socioeconomic state dishevelment that we are in, is it not then time for us to say, well, you know, they did the job that they needed to do when they needed to do the job, and they are no longer relevant for us? We need to find other ways.
No, I don't think you can say COSATU or any of the, well, let's say COSATU because it's an alliance with the ANC, is complicit in the deepening socioeconomic crisis that's affecting its own members.
Yes, you
I
can.
Don't think you can. The problem is COSATU's lost independence with which that they had in 1994.
By their own design.
And
they were party to that.
Increasingly, it's been corroded.
Nobody.
The sense of independent action in the interests of their own members and the wider working class has dwindled increasingly since 1994 under the concerted pressure of the ANC. The ANC puts enormous pressure on COSATU to toe the line.
So how come COSATU just...
There's not much to be said about that.
Why didn't COSATU stand up for themselves? I mean, you know, here
That's
you've got...
It.
If they can't stand up for themselves, how can they stand up for
Then they don't deserve.
Well, read the
they
book.
Don't deserve
Cliff, read
any
the
credit.
Book to see. I deal with COSATU. I deal with these very questions you're raising sharply. How COSATU has actually diverted and departed from the road they were on.
But you sound
in
like, Ibrahim, with all due respect, you sound like one of those people at the funeral who, when someone's life has been nothing but pathetic, you stand up for them just because it's their funeral. I mean, COSATU were party to all of this. We can't suddenly feel sorry for them and treat them as if they
party
were...
Party to what? Party to what?
Well, they were in the tripartite alliance. They went in hook, line, and sinker with the ANC. They decided that the ANC could marshal them around, and therefore they lost their agency. And if they lost their agency, I have no sympathy for that. That's their own fault.
But don't forget, COSATU is now fighting with Ibn Lutsiro. COSATU is taking a stand now because the effects has become too clear to its own workers and it's been pressurized to take a stand. COSATU is at loggerheads with the ANC in several respects.
Too late.
Why do you ignore that?
Too late.
Why do you see?
Too late. They doth protest too much. Too late.
It's never too late.
When
it comes to struggles, it's never too late.
I think Pumi has a very valid point. Maybe they've outlived their usefulness. It's a good question.
You are saying what conservative employees, and they happen to be largely white, they sing that tune.
So what?
It's time that the unions step back up.
So is it not a valid point of view?
So
I mean, are you racializing it just because you don't have a better argument against it? Maybe it's the correct point of view.
No, it's not about racializing.
Maybe it's been proven to be right.
Hold on. Can I say this? Can I ask this? We have a country of 60 million citizens, of which 25 million of our citizens are unemployed. 25 million of the employable population in this country is unemployed. So who does COSATU represent then? Who do they represent if we have more unemployed people than employed people? It's a very small faction. Very, very, very small faction. They don't. So not only have they lost their agency, they don't even have a member base now. You know, their members are too few as opposed to the people on the outside.
No, but let me tell you something. Be careful. Can you imagine what would have happened to the wages and earnings of organized workers You can't assess KwaSatu on the basis of how many people are unemployed. You've got to assess it in relation to its own members' needs and interests. I'm saying to you that if KwaSatu did not exist in organized labor in the form of trade unions, can you imagine how wages, for one thing, would have been depressed even much further down?
Well, we wouldn't have had the bureaucracy.
Unions are always...
We wouldn't have had
you
the...
You have to have unions. Even, I mean, you won't have... I mean, there are some very advanced, you know, I think white business people who would argue against it. I mean, Bobby Gotzel, for example, never would you take issue with you immediately and say the right to organize workers and trade unions must continue to exist. So I'm afraid that, you know, you're singing from the hymn of, and that's why I said the big employers wish, honestly, that, you know, they didn't have to deal with trade unions anymore. But don't forget, what is happening in KwaSatu now with the public sector wage thing? Just look at the strong stand they're taking, because they're saying, you say you can't afford the third year of this agreement, wage agreement. But what sacrifices have you made? Talking about the cabinet, the earnings, the ANC leadership. I mean, this is a salutary stand that KwaSatu has taken. And many Ashur, they're very, in fact, I think sometimes they're regretful that they supported Cyril in 2019. Honestly, I feel that, and I'm still connected
terribly
to
sorry.
Unions. I get
bad
things coming through.
I'm so sorry for
they
them.
Sometimes feel
bad things
they
happen.
Might not have been other alternatives, but I think sometimes they're very unhappy with their decision to support Cyril for his election, you know,
and
see what's happening.
I agree. I hope they're disappointed. And bad things happen because you deserve them. They deserve this. This is what they're getting. You know what South Africa doesn't deserve is the huge public sector wage bill, which the unions have been fighting for years without us getting anything more out of those people, with an expanding bureaucracy, with things we cannot afford anymore, Ibrahim. There is a reality. There's a reality that starts to dawn.
I don't know what you're talking about, because do you know what COVID has done? You have no idea what. Go and do research, my friend. Do you know what COVID, the destructive impact of COVID, even on organized labor and their earnings in the midst of soaring price rises, etc. So that is partly why the strong stand in terms of the public sector dispute, pay dispute. You are misreading the situation seriously. And what you're doing is to take your eyes away from the devastating impact of COVID on the lives of workers generally, including organized workers.
I think they're just
fighting for this public sector wage thing because for the hell of it.
Ibrahim, unfortunately,
it has had a devastating impact, Gareth, which you're ignoring.
Except, Ibrahim, for the South African like myself, who public sector workers, so KwaSatu stand and their fight, unfortunately, only looks to me, who is not receiving delivery of services from their members, because they are that protected by this hegemony you speak about.
They get their salary every month.
We don't get service. We don't get service from the police services, because the union can protect them. If they don't give us service, the union can protect them. We don't get service from our healthcare workers because the union can protect them. We get no service from the teachers
because the union can protect them.
And now when they take this tough stance about getting more money from a corrupt friend of theirs, which is the ANC, one, but two, from us, actually. They don't give us a service, but they want more money from us, money we do not have. So we're asking ourselves, why do we have to pay these people when they don't give us the service?
But who are you talking about, we?
The taxpayer.
I can't go to the police station and get the taxpayer.
In the end, that is the only person.
These were scheduled bargained increases. These were official. That's why there's a good argument, and there's a good argument why it was unlawful not to implement that third tier of the agreement. There's a lot to be said about that. You forget that. How can you reach an agreement in a statutory body and then say, no, you don't have the money, while the ANC leadership is caught up in so many acts of corruption, stealing of the fiscus, etc.? I mean, it's not a credible argument in the light of the wanton corruption of the ANC itself.
Well, you're making agreements.
You have made a valid point. Let me tell you what's an important point you've made. And I've seen this myself. I've seen it in public hospitals. I've seen it with the teachers, schools. There is no doubt, and I'm not afraid to say it now in public. The public sector unions have not conducted themselves and covered themselves in glory whatsoever. The public sector unions, I must emphasize public sector unions, and I think it's their alliance with the ANC, thinking that it provides them with a protective cover.
It has.
For whatever they want to do. I mean, how they've it's true, how they've conducted themselves during strikes, things are destroyed, whatever you want to do is
absolutely
allowed. I think it's partly to do. No, it is. I mean, it is partly to do because they're in alliance with the ANC. The ANC will defend them. They can do what they have abused their membership at times, and especially during strikes. I mean, you know, the idea of strikes is to win public support. The idea of a strike, especially public sector strikes, go and study around the world, what you must win public support and sympathy for you. You do not do it by thrashing the streets and doing what a lot of the public sector unions, I mean, I've looked at the attitude of nurses in public hospitals. It's despicable.
So
how nurses, black nurses treat black patients and people, I've seen it when my mother was even in the hospital. I've seen it and I condemn it in the strongest terms, let me tell you, and there's no doubt there's a political dynamic to it.
So
and
then,
that is what
then it sounds
they're
like
in alliance with the ruling ANC, to hell with the rest, they'll do what they want to.
I'm so glad you said that. It means that Pumi and I win that argument. I'm happy about
that.
No, but
I'm not
thank
saying
you, Ibrahim.
It to please you. I'm saying it because that is
no, it's
that
true.
Is my analysis.
I agree with you. I don't disagree with anything you've said.
You're giving us life this morning.
I know. There is some serious, you know, I can see how, and Ibrahim, I want you to just for a moment, because you are a historian, you're a commentator, you're a trade unionist, you're all of these things, but I can see it's an emotional thing for you because you're looking at these things that you helped build and you're seeing them falling apart and you're seeing them that they're meaning less and less to the people they're meant to mean the most to. And it must be very frustrating to you to see how these things have been manipulated over the last couple of years and how a very smart group of people have completely taken over. They've captured those mechanisms which were meant to have been for everybody and have now been funneled into their own pockets. It must be extremely frustrating for you.
Gareth, let me give you one example now. And I've written at great length about this Labour bulletin, newspapers, everything. It's a serious problem. Maybe you know what is needed is a focus, a big focus of discourse and discussion on it. The primary reason, and I've done my homework on this thing, and I would argue it with any of the trade union leaders, the biggest reason for what has happened, the growing corruption in the trade union movement itself, forget about the ANC and BE, all that, it must be said that the growth of the investment wings of the trade unions, I mean, it was meant to serve the interests and needs of its members. It became a source of wanton corruption. People grew rich. These investment wings were started from the funds of workers. That's how they started. And look what happened. It became the source of massive corruption. And I want to say publicly, no trade union, including COSATU, has really, I've raised this, I don't want to mention people's names here. No one has conducted serious and systematic research and investigation into the trade union arms, investment wings of trade unions, because there's a lot of unhappy, unsettling, shocking things to be found.
And there's some people.
And until you do that, and you'll find that the trade union leadership will not be in favor. I've raised this many times of that kind of investigation and research, because I think we want to talk about white monopoly capital and rest of it.
Sure.
But when it comes to these things, we want to close our eyes. It is a big problem in the labor movement that has not been dealt with, certainly not comprehensively, or even begun to have a serious debate about it.
But Ibrahim, without naming names, let's just talk for a minute about the kinds of people who have made themselves extremely wealthy using trade union investment money. And those people have found themselves on the boards of many of the companies that the unions always used to despise and were at loggerheads with. And to me, if there's ever a group, if there's ever been a group of people you could call sellouts in this country, it's got to be those people who took the money.
Now, I'm not going to argue against it. Let me tell you something. And they know these very people. I don't want to name them. I've worked with all of them. All of them right to the top, right to the Cyril, Marcel Golding, Johnny Copeland, everybody. And it must be said, otherwise you're lying to the public and the people of this country. Nowhere in Africa, if not in the world, did people go from virtual rags to riches. Let me tell you, I know all these people, where they were before, under apartheid, and became that. No, in Africa, you forget about it, you'll never find a precedent. Where trade unionists went from that rags to riches like they did in South Africa. Ramaphosa, Marcel Golding, Johnny Copeland, so many people. And look at what happened. The effect was to create a chasmic gulf between the membership of those very unions where the investment wings were created. And you look at what elite it created, the corruption, self-enrichment. It is the biggest contrast and contradiction, I believe, ever in the history of the labor movement of South Africa. Never before. It's true. It is explosive. It is sick, man. You know, you can't believe it. And they conduct their lives. They're happy with where they're living, what they're earning, what they're doing. And yesterday, they were leading trade unionists, sacrificing for the workers and doing everything else. And look what has happened in post-apartheid South Africa. Through the investment, it was created even in Noom by Motlanthe. But what they wanted to do with it is not what it ended up with. They did not want it to end up with that, you see. But I don't believe they took the necessary guarantees.
All right.
No, let me make this point. They never did what was necessary. No, to prevent the abuse of funds and the corruption that happened in the investment companies. That's what they never did.
So it was too late when
they woke up to what was happening.
All right, I want to hear what.
What's next? So then my question is, the reason we study history, the reason we look back, is so that we don't repeat those mistakes. So what then? What does the future then look like? Where do they go to from here?
No,
so they won't have the investigations. They won't have.
No. The future. I want to hear what you say about the future of the worker, because I mean, those are the people you've been closest to, Ibrahim. Forget about the unions. They've destroyed themselves, and they will continue to lose public support, and they'll continue to lose membership. But what do you think will happen for the worker? What do you think the worker has as an option?
Let me answer your question in this way. Firstly, it's a false distinction to make between the worker and trade unions. I mean, you know, it's too shallow, but I don't want to go into that. But let me tell you, we on the eve of a terrible thing that's going to come down. I've written also about it, the unions, to reflect how backward they've become, even on burning issues of the day. You take the fourth industrial revolution. It has not hit our shores yet. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, Vavi likes to talk of a jobless bloodbath. It is going to be a Sunday picnic compared to what lies ahead when the fourth industrial revolution really rolls over this country. It's imminent. In fact, I think it's been held back because of COVID, technologically. The unions have not even placed it on the agenda with management to seriously discuss how they are bound to be affected by the fourth industrial revolution. It's going to affect everything, and not just your manual workers. The bulk, in fact, of the threat of the fourth industrial revolution is not there. It's white-collar workers. Mm-hmm. It's the corporate sector. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, you know, there are some unions that organize there. They've not placed it seriously on the table with management. No one discusses the fourth industrial revolution. Though when I raise it sharply in the papers, no one even responds to it. You know, the lethargy of the trade union movement leadership is one of the most striking and shocking things in South Africa. The best union leadership was when Cyril, myself and others, Marcel Golding in the 1980s, the most committed, disciplined, believe me, things just changed after 1994. You don't have that caliber of trade union leadership, of sacrifice, etc., of the 1990s. Today, they're more concerned with what they earn and increasingly shocking salaries. I earn $550. a month. When I left the union in 1987,
all right,
850 rand I earned a month. Can you try to understand?
But this...
Look at what the people earn today. It's part of the problem.
But
it's
Ibrahim,
part of the problem.
All I hear, so what I hear from you is precisely what we see. So we are in violent agreement because of the fourth industrial revolution, because of their lethargy, and because of their, I suppose, more than anything, they're so used to being in a position of power. They are dying. They are dying. We are in violent agreement about this. There is going to be, because with the fourth industrial revolution, it happens the world over, right? Workers' wages decrease. And when workers' wages decrease, they are unwilling to share that with the union. They are unwilling to pay their union subscriptions. Less people are out there working, less membership in the unions also means that they have less leverage and less power with the government. So they will not be able to say to the government, we bring to the table this number of voters on your side, so you have to take us seriously. They're dying.
No, let me tell you, I'm very worried what lies ahead. You know, you're just talking about decline of erosion of wages as a result of the fourth. Do you know what is? Have you studied the fourth? You're going to have massive chunks of work, traditional work categories like accountants,
wiped out.
A whole lot of areas of work you will not find. So the erosion of wages is the big structural thing of how work is organized and production. Oh, robotics, artificial intelligence. What? The unions are not ready for it. I don't even think they've had serious discussions amongst themselves. I said it in articles in Business Day and other newspapers. Nobody even responds. That's the very interesting thing, you know. Letters to the editors. No, we differ with you. Well, nothing. No one says anything. I mean, nobody says anything.
Ibrahim, can I ask you quickly, because you are one of a dying breed of true believers, and you mentioned what the unions were like back in 94. I don't mean this in any patronizing way, I promise you. There are just very few people who think and talk like you left, because many of them have become those billionaires that we were talking about earlier and who've abandoned their principles. Who are the other true believers? Who are the people who you feel are still carrying that flag? Because there are some. There are people who have not sold out. There are people who believe in the workers' rights, who believe in the establishment of unions, who believe in membership of those unions, and that the leaders of those unions ought to look out for the workers. But there are very few of them. So you probably know them, and they're probably your friends.
No, it's the ordinary workers. It's the most ordinary people. That's the answer, then. It's an important question. It's the most ordinary workers and people with little education in the townships who struggle daily. I mean, whose leadership has betrayed them, whether it's the ANC or the trade unions. And there's still the stirrings, the wish, the aspirations for a change of life, increasing living standards, so legitimate. I mean, since 1652, do you know that it's the first time in 1994 that we had a non-racial democracy, where you could go and vote? I mean, except for a period in the Western Cape where, you know, you had the ballot there, the black people, it ended 1936. But, I mean, there is no country, arguably, where race and racism was so entrenched like in South Africa. No country where the exploitation was so vicious. So what happened in 1994? I mean, can you blame every worker, every person who said, the ANC coming to power, we supported them so many years. Finally, our lives are going to change. Today, go with me. You've seen it in the town. Go and see what is happening in the town. You can't believe it. It is an absolute shocking, unmitigated shame and a reflection. The ANC will hate me for this, and they'll hate me for the piece in the Business Day yesterday and the book. I know it. But there are some big people there who will appreciate. Kgalema Motlanthe is one of them. Yeah. He'll tell you, you are right there. You're right there. Okay, we differ here. That's a different, he's a very different man. But the bulk of the ANC leadership would hate you. They don't want you to talk about these things, you see. They want it suppressed. But in answer to your question, it's the ordinary working people. It's the masses, so-called. And increasingly, let me be honest with you, there's a gulf that's opening up between the formal leadership of trade unions and other civil society structures. Don't think it's just the trade unions. There are things happening, money, commercialization, etc., all over across civil society, but primarily the trade unions and through the investment wings. But a big difference is opening up for long, just like alongside the trade, the ANC membership and its leaders, the trade union membership and its followers, its members. It's big. And it's becoming increasingly greater. In fact, it's a great feature of the crisis, but not sufficiently addressed and analyzed, is the gulf that's opened up between the ANC leadership and its members and supporters in the township, the ordinary members of trade unions and their leadership. Go and look at these people live, Ibrahim, what they've done with the investment wings to enrich themselves, while their members never really enjoyed what the investment wings were originally founded to do.
Absolutely. I want to close it off because we're out of time, but this has been a long time. It's been a long time coming to have this discussion about the unions, to have a discussion about your book, which
Please, Gareth, don't exploit my views and arguments for your own agendas, please.
How would I do that? I don't know how to do that. I'm not a politician. I'm not looking for votes. Ibrahim, this is a conversation I've been wanting to have for a long time. Don't worry. You're not in the Communist Party now.
Enemy camp. Yeah.
I'm not an insurgent, I promise. This is just a really interesting conversation. If you want to read more, there's Ibrahim's book. It is called The Great Pretenders, Race and Class Under ANC Rule, and you can find out more about his points of view there and his telling of the story of just exactly the stuff we've started to indicate has happened in the unions this morning. But Ibrahim, don't worry, no exploitation. As far as I know, I have not commanded any of your labor this morning except to have some of your thoughts. And I think that's shared by all of our listeners.
One last thing, Gareth, it's not just unions. You'll be missing the picture of South Africa and what has happened. No. In fact, there are other areas that are far worse than the trade unions. So, you see, it's a question of what you've studied and focused on. Let me give you quickly.
Well, that's why I brought you, because this is something
you... worse than the trade union picture and what's happened is the townships. Okay. Gareth, wake up.
But Ibrahim,
don't see what's happening to water sanitation, sewerage.
That is the biggest tragedy
of this country, even more than the trade union problems.
I'm delighted that you're expanding this, but your sphere of influence and your particular expertise have been helpful to us in understanding something of the unions this morning.
Right.
So I don't expect you to answer all questions for all time. This was useful for the purposes that your book is useful, and I recommend it thoroughly to anyone who's interested in knowing more. I appreciate your being on the show this morning, and thank you very much. Pumi, always good to have you on. We will continue this conversation next week on The Burning Platform. Thank you so much, Ibrahim. Thank you, Pumi, and thank you most of all to you for joining us this morning. It is brought to you, as it is every week, by Nando's, and we will have more for you in the next Burning Platform. Have an awesome day today, and a luta continua, I suppose. CliffCentral.com